An invitation to learning. An invitation to sit in on a discussion of significant books.
Not much is known about the Roman poet and philosopher Lucretius beyond the fact that he left us one complete book, but that one is a masterpiece. It is the long philosophical poem On the Nature of Things. Our chairman for today's discussion of this work is Lyman Bryson. His guests are Moses Hadas, J. Professor of Greek at Columbia University and author of A History of Latin Literature, and Robert Elliott Fitch, Dean of the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, California, and author of The Decline and Fall of Sex. Now, to begin this discussion of On the Nature of Things by Lucretius, here is Lyman Bryson.
Lucretius is strange even among the real iconoclasts of the world because we know so little about him, because his attack upon the idols of his day was so profound. As a matter of fact, some of the time servers of this time, just before the beginning of the Roman Empire, like to say they hadn't read Lucretius. It was something you didn't get caught reading in public.
Yes, Mr. Bryson, the Epicureans were regarded as politically subversive. You see, the prerogatives of the ruling class at Rome in the late Republic rested on a religious differentiation. The patricians had the right to do certain things in religion which the plebeians had not the right to do. And therefore, if a man wrote a book and proved that the gods did not interfere in human affairs, and that there was no such thing as any external control whatever, that would undercut the basis for the political organization.
You can see that it's anti-clerical and opposed to current religious teaching. I suppose we need to remember that it is practical atheism, but not technical atheism. That is, Lucretius believes in the existence of gods.
He's willing to, Mr. Fitch, to say they may exist. He doesn't
seem... Oh, may.
He uses them, don't you think he uses them more as sort of a stage dressing for his great thoughts?
Well, his point is that if they do exist, they live a carefree Epicurean life, that they are not troubled by us, and we should not be troubled by them. So it's a matter of indifference whether they're there or not.
Now, this cuts right to the root, doesn't it, of the ancient idea of the state, that the state is an expression of God's will.
And at the root of religion, I mean, to say that there are gods who are off in heaven somewhere having a delightful picnic because if they had to keep book on human conduct and mete out requital and so on, what's the use of being a god? Well, for all practical purposes, there are no gods. I mean, we're just quibbling with words if we say there are gods, but they don't affect us because we define God by his effects. So that this man is actually, to all intents and purposes, atheist by our conviction, a convinced atheist, a man who is convinced that a great part of the unhappiness of the world, people's fears, people's terrors, is due to religion, and he is going to relieve them of it with this poem of his.
Isn't it rather curious that a man should have taken a long and even at its best difficult poem as a means of giving people peace of mind, Mr. Hadas?
Well, I presume that no one would think of doing it today. The question always comes up, if anyone takes Lucretius on the nature of things or the nature of the universe and reads through it hurriedly, he'll get the impression that he's looking at a textbook of physics. And, of course, nobody would dream of writing a textbook on physics, even though the physics is meant to prove that the world is material and therefore there's no need for gods in verse. But this is a poem. Here's a man who has what seems to me to be the essence of poetry, a sense of wonder. I've often wondered why nobody's written a poem about the nebula hypothesis, which is a subject for poetry. And it's very convincing because it is a poem.
There is a kinship, of course, isn't there, between the great minds in physics and in mathematics, and on the other hand, both philosophy and poetry, because after all, Isaac Newton dabbled in theology rather weirdly at times. And
Bad theology, Mr. Fitch.
Bad theology, but the point is he was attracted to it, and Albert Einstein loves music and poetry and great literature, and many great mathematicians and physicists, Leibniz would be another example, have turned, if not to poetry, at least to philosophy and larger speculations. So
I'd go further than that, Mr. Fitch. I'd say that between the poet's imagination and the physicist's imagination. There's not a relation. There's a sameness.
Well, you...
They're not quite the same quality, but they're certainly based somewhere near the same quality, aren't they?
Mr. Bryson, you're probably familiar with Burt's book on the metaphysical foundations of modern physical science, where he shows how at least the imaginative writings of Plato and the Neo-Pythagoreans had a definite influence on scientists like Copernicus and Kepler. It's the poetic vision that seems to have touched the physicist at that point.
Nobody else ever did what Lucretius did, actually take the very substance of the physics of his day and make real poetry out of it.
I think not. Some of the Greeks had done it. Parmenides wrote his philosophy and poetry, and others did it too. I think it's important to realize, out of justice to Lucretius, I mean, the modern appreciation start out by saying, isn't it remarkable that this man was a scientist and he knew about atoms and so forth? Well, actually, he's not a scientist. I was pleased with what you gentlemen were talking about, his metaphysical interests. When a man is trying to explain celestial phenomena, and he says the thunder is due to either this, or the third, or the fourth, and he has several alternatives, he isn't being a scientist.
What is he
doing? All he is trying to do is to show you that there is a natural explanation. If there is a natural explanation, then your ignorance should not be a basis for superstition. All he's trying... In other words, the science here, this is not a book of science. The science is being a scaffolding for something which to him is much more important.
It's a book that, Mr. Hattis, that presents a great scientific hypothesis, but also gives it practical significance in terms of human welfare and how we are to live in this kind of world. Would you be satisfied with that, perhaps?
Now, let's look at the hypothesis a little longer, Mr. Fitch, before we consider what he was trying to do with it.
Yes.
What is this basic scientific hypothesis? What was the physics of 2,000 years ago, almost 2,000 years ago?
The gist of it is that reality is two things, atoms and the void. Atoms differ from each other only in size and shape. There is a limited number of the kinds of atoms in the world, but there is an infinite number of atoms in each kind. And whatever we're dealing with, whether it's human sensation and feelings, or whether it's the plague or the magnet, or some extraordinary natural phenomenon, or anything in the evolution of the world, everything can be explained by the motion of atoms in the void. That's the simple statement of the hypothesis.
And this, as Mr. Hattis has just said, this completely destroys, at least Lucretius intended it completely to destroy, the idea that there is necessarily any supernatural.
Any design in the universe.
These no design, there's no supernatural.
By chance. The whole thing is fortuitous. The old expression was the fortuitous concatenation of atoms. And therefore, no design, no reward and punishment. Death is final. You've got a soul, but that's material too. Everything is material. Sometimes it gets to be a little ludicrous when he talks about the senses, the psychology of the senses. Well, all of that is matter. Actually, there's only one sense, and that is touch. When you hear my voice, what is happening in effect is that a film is leaving me and hitting your ears. When you see me, a film is hitting you. It's a sense of touch. Everything is absolutely material.
Of course, we shouldn't be too scornful of that, should we, Mr. Hattis, when we consider how long, how many centuries after Lucretius, that same kind of explanation of physiology and the senses prevailed?
Well, it's I think, the modern view is something about waves, which also is matter of a kind. But what my point would be this, that it doesn't so much matter the correctness or not. I don't think Lucretius was concerned, except that he was obviously a man with an insatiable curiosity, obviously a man with profound love for mankind and so on. Obviously a man with the poet's eye for describing things. What he wants to do is to release you and to try to show you that your happiness rests solely on yourself and nothing else.
Where did he get this?
His inheritance is from Greek thinkers like Democritus, Leucippus, and Epicurus.
Mostly Epicurus.
But it seems to me.
It's one he pays most attention to.
That's true. He cites Epicurus as the one who has enlightened the mind and delivered us from the bondage of ignorance. It's interesting to me that On the scientific side, while he is technically a materialist, he is most emphatically not a determinist or a mechanist. That is, he wants to keep freedom of the will. And to some extent, this is a device for preserving the dignity of the individual, his chance to order and direct his own life.
Now, how does he manage, Mr. Fitch, in this accidental concatenation of these atoms?
Fortuitous was my
fortuitous, word. All right, let's get it right. Fortuitous concatenation of these little particles, which are different in size and shape, but all made of the same basic substance.
He does it, Mr. Bryson, as I remember, by the simple device of insisting that the atoms, as they fall in the void, swerve. Mm-hmm. This may be related to some modern theories of the irregularity or the statistical indeterminacy of the behavior of small units of matter. I think his predictive insight here is rather interesting, but that's the way he preserves some measure of freedom and caprice, if you like.
Yeah, it is a little, however, isn't it? Like the Hindu explanation of how the universe stays up and or how the world stays up in the universe. Well, it's on the back of an elephant. Well, where's the elephant? Well, he's standing on a turtle. Well,
yes.
Where's the turtle? Well, don't ask so many questions.
Precisely.
The atoms are falling, and by Democritus's theory, if I'm not mistaken, there was no swerving. They just
quite right.
That's that. Right. But Epicurus couldn't figure out how if they just kept falling in the void, anything would ever happen, and obviously a lot of things had happened, so they must, one time or another, have wiggled a little.
Well, Mr.
Now,
Bryson,
why?
I think that the explanation of the why is a profound love for humanity.
Yes, this I would
man
agree.
This man is a great teacher. You see, the thing about these Epicureans, you read about Epicurus's life, the little we have about it, we have two or three of his letters in Diogenes Laertius. He seems to have been one of the sweetest conceivable men, kind to everybody, generous.
Like all men who founded wicked sects,
wicked
Mr. Hattis, he was a sweet, gentle,
and
kind
we
person.
We talk about him, eat, live, drink, and be merry today, for tomorrow you may die. Of course, that is a transposition of the doctrine of the calculus of hedonism. Pleasure is the one goal. But actually what these Epicureans were reveling at in their garden were orgies of geometry, because that, of course, would leave the least hangover, and that's a very pleasant thing to do. He is a sweet, dear man.
Now, you're talking to Epicurus.
Epicurus and Lucretius, who follows him as a disciple. And he wishes to do what he can for mankind, to the degree of endowing him also with a degree of choice, of moral choice and determination and so forth. And I think that this clinamen business, this swerve, is perfect nonsense. I don't know enough about science to be able to go any further than that. I think it's dictated by goodwill more than anything else, like your series of elephants and turtles. But that's why I don't want to define this man as a scientist. He isn't. He is a poet and a teacher.
And Mr. Hattis, I think we must all agree that he was gentle and kind. We're speaking of Lucretius as well as Epicurus. However, there are different ways of loving humanity, and just for the sake of clarity, we ought to realize that this kind of gentleness and kindness, shall we say, is more akin to the compassion of Mahayana Buddhism than it is to the great Hebrew prophetic passion for social justice, which means a very dynamic kind of action, or the New Testament teaching of outgoing sacrificial love. I think the Epicureans were a little bit too withdrawn from life to engage in that, I would say, more perilous type of love of mankind.
Well, I think perhaps the historical background may have something to do with it. I think the circumstances under which Epicureanism and Stoicism both arose are important. You had the little city-state suddenly disappearing, man's insulation gone. Here he'd been somebody as a member of this small community, and now he is overwhelmed by a colossal world which leaves him miniature. And he's got to find a new attitude in the face of this world. Well, there are two conceivable answers, and the Stoics took one of them, which is to make yourself part of the ruling intelligence, part of God, if you like, and that gives you a certain importance, no matter how humble your position in life may be. And the other one was to cultivate your own independence. And, you see, this kindliness may be all right for kings and princes and potentates, but what is a poor little man in the slums of Alexandria or Rome to do? He isn't going to be able to push the world around and to be kind to people. The only thing that to do is to give him a human dignity in the only way that you could give it to him.
May I make use of your definition of the kind of world that Lucretius confronted to suggest that in a larger sense, without denying for one moment that Lucretius is anti-clerical and anti-theistic, opposed to organized religion, opposed to gods. Nevertheless, in the larger sense, what you really have here is what we call a scheme of salvation. You're confronted with a certain kind of world. And you ask, in effect, what shall I do to be saved? The answer is, believe the true philosophy. Believe that everything is atoms in the void, that there are no gods, that your destiny depends upon yourself. And the Savior, whom Lucretius salutes from time to time, is Epicurus. Epicurus is the Savior who liberated man not from sin, but liberated man from superstition and ignorance, and showed him the true path and how to live. So, technically, this is a religion in that sense.
Well, technically and literally, Mr. Fitch, I'm sure that you're right, but I can't help feeling that there's a good deal of metaphor involved here, perhaps even hyperbole, to take the man who is preaching against religion and use words like salvation. Which, all right, that it means what you say it means, but it is now so definitely associated with systems of religion that I think that there's a kind of, not falsification, but there's something wrong involved in the picture of taking the man who was the evangelist. Now, I'm going and doing exactly
well,
the same thing.
Well, that's just the word I want
doing
you to
exactly
use.
The same
that's
thing.
The point. He is an evangelist. He's preaching a gospel.
A gospel of salvation, you would say, Mr. Fitch, because he says, don't think about sin. It's not important to you. Think about your superstition, your ignorance. I'll free you of that by telling you the truth. And that's your salvation.
Yes, Mr. Bryson.
And I suppose it's a matter of choice whether we call it a religious salvation or not. It's a way of life, isn't it?
That's true. But I think that there's a sort of an injustice being done to this man. Or perhaps too much justice. I shouldn't say injustice, too much justice, to use words which have become now associated in our minds pretty definitely with organized types of religion, with organized churches, creeds.
Did he have a system of ethics in addition to having this, what he thought was the flaming truth to free you of ignorance and fear?
Well, I would say only by example rather than precept. We can judge from the poetry itself when he starts out with this statement, so great, tantum religio potuits vadere malorum is the Latin line, so much evil was religion able to persuade people of, and the instance he gives is a sacrifice of Iphigenia at Aulis. He is angry that religion could be responsible for such a wicked thing as that. He is angry that religion could be responsible for taking a heifer and sacrificing it and leaving the cow desolate. He is angry at things of that sort. We can only add, of course, he is moved, as one can see, by charity.
He has the gentle ethics indicated. I'd like to bring out some other aspects of it, Mr. Bryson. I'm struck, for one thing, by the things he wants to abstain from. They are, to my mind, the most exciting and important activities of life, namely religion, politics, matrimony, and war. These are the primary areas where we find adventure and excitement. Now, Lucretius, with
the
his...
The conflict areas.
The conflict, the areas of challenge and adventure. Lucretius, with his gentleness, yes, his kindness toward others, is nevertheless, here again I'm going to use a word that Mr. Hottis may not like, I would say functionally and pragmatically he is otherworldly. Because otherworldliness, in a practical sense, is to withdraw from. the practical duties and responsibilities of life to retreat to some kind of garden, in this case. It isn't the Garden of Gethsemane, by the way.
It's the Garden of Epicurus.
Garden of Epicurus, which is quite different. And to you have a kind of new monasticism in this situation. Now, I speak as a disciple of John Dewey. I like to judge any religion or ethics by the way it operates. And operationally, it's otherworldly. It's retreating from life.
I think that something ought to be said about all of these things. I mean, you admire these tough and active and muscular types of activity. Now, on the love thing, I think we owe it to Lucretius to make this clear. They had developed in Rome in the 5th century, after the pattern of the Alexandrian poets, a cult of love. The contemporary of Lucretius is Catullus, who has an affair with a married woman and is indignant at her infidelity and says, I have been so pious to love, can you treat me this way? And he uses the word piety in a perfectly sincere sense. This is what Lucretius is talking against. He says, to get yourself all excited, to lose your calm because of an affair of this kind is bad. And then he goes on and gives you the most beautiful, it seems to me, passage on the joys of wedded life, that a woman has to be neat and amiable and a good cook, and married life is a great joy, and even if she isn't beautiful, he talks about water wearing a stone away. He has a picture of a domestic scene with the children rushing to kiss daddy and all of this. I think what he is talking about there is morality on quite an ordinary level that any preacher would talk about. He's against this extreme cult of eros, which has nothing to do with matrimony. All of these things are good if you just keep them out of your hair.
Mr. Hannes, what you've just cited about his teaching on sex, love, and matrimony caused me at one time, rather carelessly, when I was in conversation with another classical scholar, to suggest that Lucretius was essentially Puritan in his attitude toward these matters. This shocked my friend a great deal, naturally. But in this very practical view of love, that it's a matter for marriage, babies, family, that, as he says at the end of that book...
And it's very delightful. I mean, there's companionship. His picture of marriage... except that it hasn't got the blessings of the church, is as noble a picture of matrimony as anybody has drawn. It's considerably better than John Milton's, incidentally.
I'm sure of that. I have two scruples, though, here. I'd like to ask a woman, we don't have a woman on this panel, if she thinks this picture is as idyllic as we men seem to find it. And in the second place, I would observe that this is a typically... classical Athenian Greco-Roman view of matrimony, where the emotion of love is kept back, and where what we really have is a rational friendship and companionship. This is, I think, one of the serious weaknesses of the whole Hellenistic period, that they're afraid of love. Epictetus was afraid of it. He said, when you kiss your child goodnight, say under your breath to the child, tomorrow you may be dead. This is so you won't get entangled in love. Lucretius doesn't want to get entangled in love. This is why that dreadful superstition known as Christianity, I think, in part was able to conquer these particular faiths.
Well, you're talking about more than one kind of love simultaneously. As far as the erotic aspect, the relations between men and women, I don't know. I'm not expert on these matters. I myself would rather take Lucretius than to take, let's say, the picture of love that's reflected in Tristan and in Lancelot and in a good deal of European literature subsequent to that. This seems to me a much more rational basis for a sweet society and a sweet human life.
It's more sane.
Unless you accept rationalism or rationality, the rational will is the basis of happiness, you have to reject Lucretius altogether, don't you? I mean, in all things, he says, let's be rational, let's be calm, let's be thoughtful, let's avoid ignorance, let's avoid the extreme. This, in a sense, is only the reiteration with tremendous passion of the desire for moderation.
Yes.
It's one of those paradoxical things in which a passionate man says, let's be moderate, but literature is full of them.
Yes, the man himself is not moderate. And I think the point repeatedly made is that our shortcomings, our inclination towards, our propensities towards religion and the like, superstition and the like, is due to ignorance. The more we know, the less area there is left for ignorance, for this X. The bigger the X is, the more likely human beings are to fill it with things that are bad.
My difference with Mr. Hattis, and I presume Lucretius at this point, would be that I follow, shall we say, Augustine and St. Paul, or, if you like, Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, in believing that what really misleads people is the direction of their desires, of their will, and of their loves, and that these things are take precedence to some extent over reason. I'd like simply to make this other comment, though, that there's a kind of modernity in Lucretius in his quest for ataraxia, tranquility, which today we would render as peace of mind. Our own age is a neo-Hellenistic age, and we have apostles like Norman Vincent Peale, who teach us the power of positive thinking. I'll take Lucretius, frankly, over that cleric any time, in spite of the lack of theology. But there is much that's very modern in Lucretius.
Well, don't you make a choice as to whether or not you accept this Epicurean point of view that Lucretius makes so wonderful in poetry, largely by temperament. You're either the kind of person who says, I can make my life best, I can give it its best order, its best achievement by passion and by directing my will to good desires, and the other who says, let me keep my will under the control of my reason, and that will give me my best peace.
For today's conversation about On the Nature of Things by Lucretius, Chairman Lyman Bryson's guests were Robert Elliott Fitch and Moses Hattis. Next week at this same time, the subject of discussion will be Zadig by Voltaire, and our guests will be D.W. Brogan and Andre Michalopoulos.
Invitation to Learning has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.